With that, I'd like to introduce today's speaker, William Derry, or Bill Derry. He received his Bachelor of Science and Master's degree in Forest Resources, and as he told me, right here in this room, they have a graduation ceremony right here, so it's kind of nice coming back. And I'd say it's always exciting when a UW grad such as Bill Derry goes out there and does a successful thing, as you'll see, and comes back to talk to you. He has pages and pages of accomplishments that I could go on and on about, and I'll highlight a few here. He is the Vice President for CH2M Hill, and he's been the Vice President since 1992. He's currently managing the following projects. He's creating tools and processes for setting the countywide investment priorities for the aquatic resource management in Whatcom County. He also developed the Lake Whatcom Watershed Stormwater Management Plan. He developed the Stormwater Pollution Prevention Plan for SeaTac Airport and 120 tenants. He's also in charge of a comprehensive receiving water study for SeaTac Airport, which involves intensive monitoring and analyses. And he's serving on the board of directors for the People for Puget Sound. And other of his accomplishments, he created this Snohomish County Surface Water Management Utility. He managed the program for 9 years. He also helped to create the Stormwater Managers Committee for the Washington chapter of the American Public Works Association, and he still co-chairs it 20 years later. And he was the one who helped to create and found the Board of Directors and the Center for Urban Water Resources here at UW, which became the Water Center, and he's a member of our advisory board. So with that, let's offer a warm, grateful, enthusiastic welcome to Bill Derry.
Thank you, Ann. Good morning. Welcome to Winter Quarter. It is, as Ann said, I really did. Anybody here from College of Forest Resources? Do you still have graduation ceremonies here? You have to go to the big one.
Nope.
Oh, but you do have your own.
Yes.
Okay. That's cool. I really did get, we used to have graduation ceremonies here in this room, and so it's kind of a treat to come back. So, thanks, Anne, for that very glowing introduction. I'm here today to talk about stormwater and something I've been working with all of my career, basically, in one way or another, that and resource management, but it tends to become all the same thing after a while. So there's been a lot of talk, and a lot of people like to jump down to the site level. What can we do on an individual site to deal with stormwater? And what I want to do is step back and take an ecosystem picture and hopefully convince you that dealing with issues at the site level isn't adequate. We need to take a bigger perspective. So that's the gist of what I'm going to be saying today. So what's all the shouting about? There's been a lot of talk about trying to restore Puget Sound as well as recover salmon. And we know that stormwater is a big piece of both of those issues. And we know that what has been proposed and what has been done is not adequate. For example, some of the things we know, the Puget Sound PSP, Puget Sound Plan, that was released a little over a year ago, fall of 2006, by the first partnership for Puget Sound. And in that document itself, this was the plan to recover Puget Sound, and that document says the strategies listed are not likely to be sufficient to achieve ecosystem goals. And that's under the stormwater section. Similarly, the Washington State Department of Ecology has written a manual that tells jurisdictions how to manage stormwater. The state's own stormwater manual says, land development as practiced today is incompatible with the achievement of sustainable ecosystems. So again, if we just look at the site, it doesn't really matter what we do on that site, it's not going to get us there. We also know from the literature and research, as well as experience, And by the way, the best body of stormwater research in the country came out of this campus from the Center for Urban Water Resources. And it's used across the country as the basis of developing approaches to stormwater. So we know ecosystems are more complex than we know. And ecosystems are more complex than we know how to think. And that is paraphrased from Jack Ward Thomas, who was heading up the Spotted Owl recovery a few years ago. So we don't even, the systems are so complex, we don't even know how to think about them or analyze or discuss them. We know with a high degree of certainty that Puget Sound and its tributary streams and rivers are degraded and they are declining. And the wildlife populations are crashing, whether we look at fish or birds. We know that human population growth is essentially unrestrained and will continue for the foreseeable future. We know that Puget Sound will continue to decline even if we were able to stop growth. If we could say no more building today, Puget Sound would continue to decline because of the impacts that are already in the system driving that trend. It would take years, decades, maybe longer for the Puget Sound to come back, even if we stopped building. The majority of lowlands in the Puget Sound basins has been deforested and converted to other human uses. I'll talk more about that. So, as you can see, this is about 10 years old now, so the trend has continued. This is enhanced, but it is an actual photo showing the loss of forest over the region. And you can see it's throughout the Puget Sound region. It's not just in Seattle or King County. Another way to look at the same image or the same issue, and again, you can see this came from UW, developed land, and if I remember, this is from assessor's records, county assessor's records. But again, you see the same trend. It's not just our cities. We are stripping forest and converting to other uses throughout the watershed. And the whole map basically is the watershed of Puget Sound here, at least in this case, the eastern half of it. Yet another way to look at this same issue is the last slide was developed area. This is impervious surface, so rooftops, walkways, driveways, streets, and parking areas. And you can see pretty significant area of impervious surface. And the yellow is farmland. So, again, the forest has been stripped. And it doesn't really matter where you go in Puget Sound, you'll see the same things happening. So we know with a high degree of certainty from our research as well as from experience that removing forest and creating impervious area and drainage systems associated with that alters stream hydrology. We know that the peak flows go up, more water runs off quickly, and the low summer flows tend to decline. And that delivers more pollutants into the streams and into Puget Sound. We know that altered stream hydrology degrades stream habitat, tends to scour out habitat, make wider and shallower streams. We know that stormwater, and pretty much anywhere in the country, we all do the same thing. We drive the same cars. We all more or less put the same products on our gardens. Stormwater, whether you're down in the Duwamish or in the residential areas, it contains heavy metals, especially zinc and copper, which are extremely problematic because, one, they're very toxic in very low doses, and two, they're dissolved, which means it's extremely difficult to get rid of them once they're in the water. None of our practicable management practices today remove more than half of zinc or copper dissolved. Oil and grease, total suspended solids, TSS. Nutrients, phthalates. Phthalates are in any of your plastics, but also in shampoo and consumer products. They keep things soft. And pesticides, a whole range of pesticides for vegetation as well as animals. And our available technologies cannot eliminate these contaminants. These contaminants tend to pass straight through a pond, straight through filters, with very few, very expensive exceptions. They tend to pass straight through swales. Anything that flows through, they're not going to be removed. We know with a high degree of certainty that road systems first remove the forest cover and the soils. They add impervious surface, and within our urban areas, 65% of our impervious areas are for cars, car habitat. And they increase runoff. They generate pollutants. Every road almost has a ditch, usually on both sides. And that's just slicing a gash through the soil, sucking the water out of the soil, taking the water off the roadway surface, and shooting it straight to a creek. So my own belief is the ditch system associated with roads has as much or more to do with the impact as the road itself. They destroy stream habitat, and as well as riparian habitat, and the culverts that are necessary for roads create fish blockages. Now, this slide is pretty much totally my position, but here it is. There is no science and no historic example to support the concept that stormwater management practices can sustain hydrologic regimes and water quality to the extent needed to protect, let alone restore, aquatic resources of Puget Sound or its streams in developed areas. We can't point to an example where we have taken degraded ecosystems in an urban area and recovered them, restored them to anything approaching historic levels. And our science doesn't really, there's no clear science that would support that we can do that either. So I'm laying the case for we need to do a pretty radical change in our approach if our goal is really to recover our streams and Puget Sound. Therefore, refinements to current practices won't be enough. If we just tweak the stormwater manual from the state, tighten up the restrictions a little bit, that's not enough. We need to change our lifestyles, our land use, and we need better regulations. Our dependency on cars is a huge factor in the degradation of the environment. We need more public education and funding. The general public, go to a party, ask someone, they don't get it. They don't understand the issues or how badly degraded Puget Sound is. It still looks pretty. The water, you look at it, it looks clear. It's not apparent what the issues are. So a little bit of background science. This came from Chris May, who also got his PhD here. This just shows what happens in a forest environment. Many of you may have seen a version of this before. But we know in a forested environment that 37%, more than a third of it, of the rainfall either never reaches the ground, and if you want to understand that, walk outside and kick a tree, and you'll feel the amount of water that comes down on you from it. So either never reaches the ground or reaches the ground and is pulled right back out by the trees, either through evaporation or transpiration. We know that about 20, this, you probably can't read that, but the middle row, the interflow, that's the soils. About a quarter of the water goes into the soils and runs off fairly quickly within days or certainly weeks. back to the streams. And a little more than a third goes into the deep groundwater. And you'll notice that less than 1% actually goes directly to stream flow. We'll add that interflow later. But in that, right during the storm, less than 1% is actually going into the creeks. Now, what happens when we develop land, first and foremost, we strip the trees, and the first thing developers do is get rid of all the good topsoil. Scrape it off down to mineral soil. It's easier to build. And then later we add some impervious surfaces like roofs and roads. And the result is, instead of 37% going into the air, we have 25%. Instead of 36% going into the ground, we have 15%. Interflow, interestingly, is about the same, 1% different. So the stuff going into the shallow soils doesn't change that much. The amount going to the streams has gone from 0.3 to 35%. That's a 100-fold increase in the amount of water going directly into creeks. So now you can begin to imagine the amount of energy that's scouring up the streams, blasting out any salmon, eggs certainly, pushing gravel down the creek, cutting into the banks, delivering a lot of sediment into the stream system. Jim Carr, also out of the University of Washington, developed this along with Chris May. This shows benthic index of biotic integrity. So in other words, go into a stream channel, kick the gravel and count the bugs that drift into a net, and then classify them out. It's more sophisticated than that, but that's basically it. And we know across the bottom of the chart is impervious area. So, for example, over here, we see 10% impervious surface, and we see a pretty good decline in habitat already, as indicated by the benthic index. And what is 10%? 10%, we're in the range of 2 to 5 acre lots. So 2 to 5 acre lots, that's a very rural area, low density development. We're already seeing significant decline in habitat. And certainly by the time we get out to urban densities, the habitat is pretty well gone and it's pretty flat, the curve. So to move, our typical city area would be somewhere in here, and to move left, we got to go a long way before we actually see improvement in the ground. So again, just tweaking things a little bit isn't likely to. That curve is pretty flat until you're all the way back to the beginning. So that has impacts on making decisions for how we manage a resource and what's achievable. Another way to look at this is a graph I helped develop working on a project up in British Columbia about 10 years ago now. But if you look across the top row, you see a representation of what a watershed might look like with the very first level of development and then increasing density of development. In the middle row, you see the hydrology of the streams and how it changes. And you'll notice, by definition, the one-year flow, that's the dashed blue line, occurs once a year, oddly enough. But as we increase the impervious area, look at how many times that one-year flow is exceeded and how much higher the peak flows are. Also look at the number of runoff events. Typically, as I said, in a normal rain like today, you're not going to have any runoff from a forest area. Strip away the forest and the soils, it's going to run off every time it rains. So now the streams get hammered almost every day in the winter around here. So that translates directly into changes in the stream channel. It starts to scour out, become larger, tends to get flatter and wider, more like a southwest stream, because it's getting hammered by those events.
And then we see a response in the biology. And all the evidence, you know, whichever little piece of the puzzle we look at, it tends to say the same thing. Fairly significant degradation with minimal disturbance. So then that leads us, okay, well, again, what do we do about it? Well, as a society, we said, pretty much, we don't want it to get any worse. So we pretty much take that off the table. We also know that, based on the science, we can't imagine how we could ever get back to pristine conditions. So when we say restore or recover, I don't think anybody's really talking about coming back to historic levels of salmon production or historic health, abundance, diversity in Puget Sound. So then we have a very difficult decision as a society. Where do we want to be between those two? And that comes down to affordability and the community's willingness to pay, which is directly related back to understanding and education.
So, I'll skip over this. This basically, using that prior graph, we can work through with the community where they want to be, and then from that, write very specific goals, measurable criteria, so that if we're successful, we'll know it. Without that specificity, you don't know if you've gotten where you wanted to get or not, and you won't know why. So what's the solution to all this?
Okay, we got 20 more minutes.
Put the forest back. Any questions? Solutions. I actually got 10 to recommend. First, discuss population and immigration. Manage land use better. We need to address the issues at three scales: the watershed scale, the community scale, and the site scale. I'll come back to these. No expansion of UGA, that's the urban growth area. Right now we have a great Growth Management Act. It essentially says, let's slow down how quickly we destroy the environment. Let's drive growth into the urban areas for a while. And then we'll expand those. And I'm saying, no, let's freeze those and say urban growth is here. Protect and restore habitat. Protect the best, which generally means forested around here. No net loss of forest cover. So if you're going to cut down trees, plant them somewhere else. Just like our policy on wetlands now. Mandatory restoration of forest. Nobody is required to go back and restore forest right now. With the exception of the timber companies. Preserve and restore buffers. Nobody's really required to restore buffers now. Change new development practices. Get to a zero discharge of stormwater, which is essentially what the forest is. And channel growth into existing urban areas. Mandatory retrofit of developed areas. There's no requirement now for cities or counties to go back and retrofit existing development. Lots and lots of regulations on new development. But there's nothing that requires them to go back and do something about the area that's already been damaged. Limit roads, no extension or expansion for single occupancy vehicles in urban areas. Require pervious pavement, so let the rain go down through the pavement. Reduce width for residential streets. Independent, number eight, an independent assessment of restoration and progress towards restoring fishable swimmable waters in each jurisdiction. Fishable swimmable is the term that comes out of the Clean Water Act. And right now, nobody's evaluating whether cities or counties are doing what's necessary to restore. We need a regional monitoring program. Right now, it's fragmented in many, many, many different agencies and doesn't provide the level of information that's needed. And all of this is going to require money. So number one, and this is quick, I won't dwell on this, discuss population and immigration. And this is what seems to be one of those taboo subjects that people don't want to talk about, so they skip over. but I at least want to say it. Population growth is unrestrained and will continue. So the governor has set the goal of restoring Puget Sound by 2020. In that time, we'll have almost another 1.5 million people in this area. So we're going to add another, basically, western half of King County. At the time we're going to be restoring Puget Sound, there's, you know, something that, like, in opposition there. The U.S. birth rate is near replacement level. So in other words, our population growth is on a steep curve, but it's not coming from us. I mean, that was a politically incorrect way to say that. The growth is largely coming from immigration. And economic growth is not dependent on population growth. And a lot of people tend to assume that, but it's simply not true. So, getting back to stormwater, as I said, we must approach stormwater management at three scales. The watershed scale, what's the best? And let's protect that and channel growth into other areas. At the community scale, like a city of Kirkland or Bothell or Bellevue, if we're going to limit growth outside, we need to increase the densities inside the urban areas. At the same time, we need to learn better how to make a higher density community more livable and sustainable. And we need to figure out how to save trees at the same time. And City of Seattle and the state legislature this session will be looking at laws to require more trees in urban areas. No expansion in the urban area. I already talked about that. So where's the best? This is an aerial photo. It's about 10 years old in Pierce County. So the gray pixels, sort of cancerous-looking cells, that's impervious area. And that's Tacoma and the surrounding communities. And you can see that urban disturbance. If you look at Fort Lewis, and that's probably pretty close to, that's a forest. And that's what this map should, or photo should look like. But you can see, in comparison, how much of the forest has been removed. And this goes essentially almost to the crest of the Cascades. So you can see, we've stripped forest all the way out to the national forest, or the commercial forest, and even that, large parts of that have been clear cut. So we need to be serious about, if we're going to restore, well, wait a minute, we're busy stripping away everything that supports the ecosystem, so how are we going to restore? So protect the best. To do that, we need to know where and what the best is. We need a combination of regulations, purchasing, funding, governance, channel growth, and stop building roads. And I show this picture as an example of what we've done as a society. This is Bothell, and I know it's fuzzy, but you can tell the main street down here of old Bothell. Little buildings, little streets, narrow streets, very compact community, everything's walkable. And as we go north, you can, hopefully even in the back there, you can get a general sense that the streets are wider, the houses are bigger. Now, instead of a grid street system, we have cul-de-sacs, so you have to walk out to the end of your cul-de-sac, and then because there's no street grid system, you have to walk a long way around. So where we started with a nice, compact, walkable community, we prevent that now. We design residential areas to make them so you can't walk anywhere, so you're totally dependent on cars to get to school, to go to the grocery store, or to get to work. Basically for anything. At the community scale, increase higher densities. If we get 11 houses per acre, that's generally what we need to support transit. And as well as sustainable communities. We can do that on 3,500 square foot lots, which used to be the standard. if we look in the nice areas around the around here, for example, or move out to Wallingford or up into the Ravenna areas, those tend to be 3,500 square foot lots, which is plenty. We need to reduce our dependency on automobiles. Narrow down our streets, current standards for a 100-year party. You have to have parking on both sides and be for a fire truck, two fire trucks with their doors open to pass. Our standard residential street width is 44 feet, and that's what it's based on. We don't need streets that wide. We need streets that are 14 feet, 14 or 16. And as I said earlier, 60. If you look at an aerial photo of any urban area and measure it, you'll find that about 65% of the impervious surface is car habitat, either driveways, streets, or habitat. Parking. If we have mixed-use neighborhoods, then we can walk to work and school. This is some specific information about how to address that, how to accomplish that, and make it livable. Okay, moving to the site scale, very briefly, we need to, within each site, we also need to reduce the impervious surface, which generally means go up, infiltrate, save the soil so that stormwater can be put back into the ground, and then we need to do something with the runoff that comes off the roofs. And either a vegetated roof or store it and reuse it. And I've done a number of studies that demonstrate that this is feasible, and if we do all of that, we can get very close to zero discharge. You may have heard a lot of talk about low-impact development, or LID, and essentially that's the concept of sticking it in the ground. And we do that by reducing impervious area or designing and constructing soils, preserving first, and then where disturbed, come back in with the right soil mix and design so that stormwater can, in fact, get into the ground. And yes, even on till, this works with the right amended soil. So lots of different techniques at the site scale, even things existing homeowners can do. Okay, back to my list of 10. Solution number 3, protect and restore habitat. Protect the best. No net loss of forest cover. Restore forest. And right now, as I said, in all those disturbed areas outside of commercial forest production, there's no requirement for anybody to put trees back. Preserve and restore buffers. Olympia Aquatic Habitat Evaluation Management Report. This is a project I did for the city of Olympia. We went in and we evaluated every watershed, 9 of them, for their resource value and ranked all of that with very specific measurable criteria. And then came up with a table that showed the value of each watershed. Based on that, we worked with the city to develop management practices, and they actually adopted them and implemented them. For example, in the western side of Olympia, Green Cove Creek is a reference stream for coho, meaning it's a real good stream for coho. And we said, you must protect that stream. That's your highest value stream. These are the criteria we used and the results. And therefore, the science tells us if we get over 10% impervious surface and we lose, or if we have less than 65% forest cover, we're going to lose the stream. We're going to see dramatic declines in stream production. So the only way to do that is to channel growth from that watershed into other parts of the city. And that's not an easy sell in a city. But that's what they did. That's exactly what they did. They changed their comp plan, lowered the densities in the top watershed, drove the densities into the highly degraded watersheds already. Mandatory restoration of forest and riparian corridors. I would like to see a requirement for counties to restore a certain percentage of forest every year. If If we set a goal of 2%, for example, it would take us 50 years to get there. And I don't know that 2% is, there's no magic in that number, but I'd like to see someone toss a number out there and say, yes, let's buy into this concept. We need to determine what's appropriate and achievable tree cover in cities. And as I said, in the legislature right now, or this session, they'll be discussing that, as well as City of Seattle. I'd like to see a mandatory standard for restoring buffer areas in cities and counties. No requirement for that now. And to help do this, allow transfer development rights for private developer. New regulations, zero discharge. If you're outside the UGA, limit total impervious area to 10%. Mandatory retention of 65% forest cover. To allow that, allow clustering and relax height limits. Reduce our residential street standards, eliminate curbs, that's so the water can sheet flow off onto grass rather than run down a curb to a catch basin and a pipe. No net loss of forest, no net loss of riparian or shoreline buffers. Number five, mandatory stormwater retrofit for treatment and flow control. A lot of people focus on new development, but if we look at an aerial photo, and this is all one aerial photo, with Seattle over here, and again, just look at the gray, you can see the level of development that's already occurred. If we just focus on new development, that's just going to slow down the decline. It won't restore anything, let alone protect. So we must have a standard for restoring or retrofitting, meaning go back and put detention and treatment for stormwater in the urban areas. If we said 5% per year retrofit, that would take us 20 years, and our goal, which would take us beyond the governor's goal of restoring Puget Sound. King County did a concept for Seattle Center on how to do this. There's many ways to do it. Seattle has shown how to do it with a number of projects throughout the city, reducing pavement and constructing infiltration facilities. This is a project we did for Seattle and out in the Venema Creek Basin, and again, we showed, yes, it's feasible to do this, even in an existing built-out area. Number six, prohibit toxics in consumer products. There's, as I mentioned before, there's a lot of pollutants in stormwater, and as stormwater managers, we have no way to get rid of them. These dissolve contaminants, we don't have tools to get rid of them. The only way to control them is to prohibit them. So phthalates are in all, as I said, all of our soft plastics and shampoo and hand lotion, lots of our consumer products. And they're simply for convenience to make it a little nicer. They're not necessary in most cases. Dissolve copper, zinc, and phosphorus. Copper, of course, plumbing, a lot of copper roofs and copper buildings. Perhaps the biggest source is brake linings. All of our cars, including mine, has copper in the brakes. It helps with temperature control, is my understanding. But there are alternatives available. And with something coming from your car, it gets washed off the street directly into the water system. So it's particularly challenging. Zinc comes from tires. They put zinc in tires, and as they wear, the zinc is released into the stream. It becomes dissolved. Again, we can't get rid of it. Phosphorus is a nutrient. It's in, it causes the algae blooms in lakes and damage to our lake systems. As I said, limit roads, get back to a grid system rather than cul-de-sacs, get back to alleys with our services. This allows us to reduce our street widths. And a lot of these kind of seemingly radical ideas, as you can see here, this alley is in the Ravenna area just north of here. It's the way we used to do things. These aren't radically new ideas. Let's get back to what we used to do. They were better. Solutions. So, solution number 8. We need an independent assessment of cities and counties, not their own self-assessment that's turned into an agency that doesn't ever look at them. We need to fund regional monitoring. And overall, what I'm suggesting, no question, is expensive and a lot of money is going to be needed. One alternative that people say is, why don't we just build treatment plants? Well, this is one we designed and built down in California, Santa Monica. SMRF and Santa Monica Urban Runoff Facility. This is very expensive, and it doesn't do anything about the flow. Of course, in California, it doesn't matter because they've paved their creeks. But the one big drawback of this, other than it's hugely expensive, is it doesn't do anything to protect the creeks. It takes water out of the creeks, sends it down to the end of the line, treats it, and releases it directly into the ocean. That's it.
We have a couple minutes for questions.
Talk a little bit about why curbs are evil again. Curbs are evil, that's a statement that comes from Patrick Condon at the University of British Columbia. Stormwater, the whole focus of stormwater management is to do what happens in the forest, which is put it back in the ground. Now, if we have a road surface, well, first, put in impervious pavement so the water goes down through the pavement. And we may need to wait until a lot of road engineers retire before we can change that. But there's really no reason why we can't use impervious pavement for our street systems. But then, even with existing roads, roads are crowned, so water runs off. And when it runs off to the side, if there's no curb, in a very shallow layer, it flows across the grass. And if it's very shallow, it's pretty effectively treated, filtered, and contact with the soil and ability to infiltrate. We can get very good treatment and slow down the runoff or infiltrate. If you put a curb in there, now it hits that curb, now it's like 2 inches deep. And it's going to run down the length of that curb at a high speed because it's paved and smooth. So you have a concentrated flow of water, high in pollutants, can run into a catch basin, run down the pipe to where it's discharged. And now you've got a big slug of fast-moving water. How do you treat that? Virtually all treatment relies on slowing down the water and somehow getting into contact with soil or a physical filter or a chemical filter. That all requires getting a thin layer of water in contact with another surface. And if you have a curb, that's exponentially more difficult.
One more question.
What are your thoughts about phyto remediation?
That's
like as a quicker fix.
Very much the same issue. It's very effective. It can be effective with wetland systems. It can be effective with hybrid cottonwoods. And cottonwoods have been hybridized to target individual pollutants. And they become very effective in the root system and the mycorrhizae and the soil community associated with vegetation removing a wide range of contaminants, including contaminants that are very difficult for us to remove in any other way. The challenge becomes, similar to the curbs issue, that works very well in a rural area or an area where you have very large space. In an urban area, it tends to take a lot of space, and that's very difficult. Having said that, some of the newer stormwater DPs, again, it's going back to the common sense of ways things used to be done. But we've gone through a sequence of looking at very
sophisticated treatment boxes, filters. Some of the best performing ones now are basically take a street tree, put it in a box of sand, so you got a sand filter, but now put a tree in it, and the organic material and the incredibly complex community of tiny little buds that are associated with the tree keep that meat, that they add different materials to remove pollutants, different chemical processes instead of just sand. There's organic matter in here that binds up different types of pollutants. They also, all those little critters and the roots, keep it loose so that it doesn't get, it doesn't blind off from sediment. So, and again, we see that in lots of different treatment facilities. The vegetation community keeps it loose so that water can go down in it. The vegetation itself, as well as all of the living community in the soil is associated with it, are effective at removing pollutants. Long answer, sorry.
I'd like to add one more impressive thing about Bill Beer's career. He is a rock star.
No.
He has his own rock band, he also plays solo, classic rock. He's great. To find out his gig schedule, go to BillDeeringMusic.com. Bill Deering Music, one word, B-I-L-L-D-E-R-R-Y-A-N-G.